Before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. If you're prepping for the Series 7, they've got a full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and like unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com. It's honestly a fantastic resource if you are trying to get this material properly locked in.
Yeah, it really changes the game when you can practice under, actual exam conditions.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I hear that all the time. So today we are tearing into a massive stack of Series 7 exam prep materials, SEC rule books, and FANAR guidelines. Our mission for this deep dive is to be your ultimate shortcut to mastering new issues in underwriting.
Right.
And we're not going to just read a list of dried rules. The goal here is to deeply understand the why. Like, how does a security go from a wild idea floating around in a founder's head to, actual regulated shares sitting in a retail investor's account?
Yeah, because that underlying logic is your safety net. If you understand the why, like the actual reason the SEC or NRA created a rule in the first place, the regulations stop being just random trivia.
Exactly.
They become a predictable system. So on test day, you can deduce the answer to a question you've never even seen before just by knowing how the financial system is like fundamentally designed to behave.
Which is huge for the Series 7. So before anyone can sell a brand new security to the general public, they have to throw a massive, highly regulated party. And the bouncer at the door of this party is the Securities and Exchange Commission, right? The SEC.
The ultimate bouncer.
Right. So to understand how you get past the bouncer, we need a scenario. So I want to introduce our main character for today. Let's call him Frank the Founder.
Okay, tell me about Frank.
So Frank has invented the world's first inflatable dartboard.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it is an objectively terrible idea. I mean, you throw a sharp dart, the board pops immediately, and the game is over.
A flawless business model.
Obviously. But Frank is a visionary. He has somehow built a startup around this.
Mm.
And he wants to take his company public. He wants to do an initial public offering, an IPO, to raise millions.
A brave, slightly delusional endeavor.
Very. So to do this, Frank goes to the SEC to register his shares. Now, this registration process is broken down into three distinct phases, and the behavioral rules for Frank change drastically depending on which phase he is currently in. The first phase is the pre-filing period. This is, the timeline before Frank has officially submitted his registration paperwork to the SEC.
And the overarching rule for this pre-filing period is just a total blackout.
Total blackout.
Frank cannot make any written or oral offers to sell his inflatable dartboard stock to anyone. If he goes on a late night financial talk show to hype up his upcoming IPO, he's breaking the law.
Wow.
If he blasts out a mass email telling investors get their checkbooks ready, he is violating federal securities law.
Which makes perfect sense when you think about the why. Because, I mean, the SEC was born out of the ashes of the 1929 stock market crash, right?
Yeah.
Where companies would hype up worthless stock, take retail investors' money, and just vanish.
Exactly.
So the SEC wants to aggressively prevent companies from artificially inflating demand before they have filed real audited financials that the public can review.
Right. But, and this is important, the Series 7 exam will try to catch you right here.
Okay.
Because they want to know if you understand that there is one major exception to this blackout rule.
Right.
And that exception is the WKSI, the well-known seasoned issuer.
Okay, so a WKSI is... it's a massive, widely followed, established company.
Right.
We're talking about a giant tech conglomerate or like a major pharmaceutical company.
Yeah, Apple, Microsoft, those guys.
Right. They already have billions in publicly traded stock, and they file quarterly reports that Wall Street analysts scrutinize every single day.
And because the WKSI is already so transparent and the market is constantly like pricing in their information, the SEC gives them a free pass. A giant tech company can make pre-filing offers if they want to issue a new batch of stock. If they do it in writing, it's called a free writing prospectus, and they just file it with the SEC later.
Gotcha.
But for our guy Frank, who is an unproven IPO issuer doing this for the first time, the SEC does not trust him at all. Total blackout.
Total blackout for Frank. Okay, so Frank finally gets his accountants together, he finishes the paperwork, and he submits his registration statement. We now cross the threshold into phase two, which is the cooling off period, also known as the waiting period.
Right.
The SEC is now reviewing his paperwork, checking for completeness. And this period lasts a minimum of 20 days.
Minimum.
Now, if you are listening to this right now, I want you to ask yourself a question and really think about the answer. During this 20-day waiting period, can Frank collect money from eager investors? Give yourself a second.
The answer is an absolute non-negotiable no. No sales can be finalized. No money can be collected. No binding commitments can be made. If Frank takes a single dollar during this 20-day window, he has severely violated the law.
Okay, but he doesn't just sit in a dark room for 3 weeks, right? Like, he is allowed to build momentum.
Right. He can do certain things.
So during the cooling off period, Frank and his underwriters are allowed to make oral offers. They can call up big institutions and pitch the inflatable dartboard concept. They can also publish what is known as a tombstone ad, which I love the name of this.
It's a great name.
It really is. A tombstone ad is just a bare bones, unhyped announcement. It literally just identifies the company, the type of security, the amount being offered, and where you can get a prospectus. It is completely stripped of all persuasion.
Yeah, it's just the facts. And they are also allowed to gather indications of interest. This is a crucial term to know.
Indications of interest.
Right. An indication of interest is Frank asking a hedge fund, hey, if we actually launch this at $20 a share, how many shares might you theoretically want?
Sure.
Exactly. It is completely non-binding for both the buyer and the seller. And the primary tool Frank uses to gather those indications of interest is the preliminary prospectus, which everyone on Wall Street calls the red herring.
Yeah. And I think the red herring is best understood through a simple analogy. Imagine you receive a wedding invitation in the mail. It tells you the names of the people getting married. It tells you the dress code, and it gives you all the background information on the couple.
Okay.
But it has no date and it has no venue listed. It deliberately omits the final actionable details.
That is the perfect way to look at it. The red herring contains Frank's business history, the risks of inflatable dartboards, all the audited financials, but it deliberately omits the final public offering price and the effective date.
And it gets its name because of the ink, right?
Yeah, it gets its name because there is a literal red ink legend printed on the side of the cover stating that the registration is not yet effective. The SEC mandates that red ink so nobody confuses it for a final document.
Okay, so the red herring gets you conversations, it gets you offers, and gets you interest, but it does not get you cash.
No cash.
Which brings us to phase three, the post-effective period. So the 20 days are up, the SEC clears the registration, and the cooling off period ends. The bouncer finally drops the velvet rope.
And sales can finally happen, money can finally change hands. But there's a massive condition, which is that all purchasers must receive a copy of the final prospectus, which now includes that final offering price and the official effective date.
Okay, so if you are taking notes, put a giant star next to this next part, because it is a classic trap on the Series 7.
Oh yeah, they love this.
It is called the 48-hour rule. For an unlisted IPO like Frank's inflatable dartboards, the rule states that the preliminary prospectus must reach expected purchasers at least 48 hours before the confirmation of sale is sent.
Right. This is a pure investor protection mechanism. If a retail investor is buying into an unproven brand new IPO, the SEC wants to guarantee they have at least 2 full days to just sit at their kitchen table, read about the risks of a popping dartboard, and back out before they are fully financially committed.
Yeah, because they need that time.
But
I see people confuse this 48-hour rule with the aftermarket prospectus delivery rules all the time.
All the time. And you have to compartmentalize them.
Right.
The 48-hour rule is about getting the document to the initial buyers before the trade is confirmed. The aftermarket delivery rules dictate how many days after the IPO a prospectus must be delivered to people buying the stock in the secondary market.
Okay.
So, for example, if Frank's IPO gets listed on an exchange like the NYSE, dealers have to deliver a prospectus to secondary buyers for 25 days after the IPO.
Okay, 25 days for listed.
Right. But if it's an unlisted, over-the-counter stock, that requirement stretches to 90 days.
90 days. So keep those separate in your mental filing cabinet, guys. 48 hours before the confirmation for the initial IPO buyers.
Yeah.
25 or 90 days after the IPO for secondary market buyers.
Exactly. Just keep them totally separate.
Okay. So Frank, the founder, has this regulatory timeline mapped out, but he can't possibly sell millions of shares of his company by himself from his garage. He needs professional distribution. He needs a crew.
He does.
Enter the syndicate. The syndicate is a temporary group of investment banks and broker dealers who band together to distribute the new issue to the public. To explain how this works, we need two new characters. First, we have Cautious Carl. Carl is the lead managing underwriter at a major investment bank. He is forming the syndicate.
Okay, Cautious Carl.
And second, we have Selling Group Sam. Sam runs a smaller broker-dealer who just wants to sell shares to his retail clients and collect a commission.
Love it. So the entire financial architecture of this IPO rests on the legal contract signed between Frank the founder and Cautious Carl. This is the underwriting commitment. And there are two primary types of commitments that you need to be able to compare side by side on the exam: firm commitment versus best efforts.
Let's break those down. In a firm commitment, Cautious Carl steps up and buys the entire issue of stock directly from Frank.
The whole thing.
The whole thing.
Yeah.
Carl wires Frank a massive sum of money. Frank is thrilled. He has all the capital he needs, and he goes back to his warehouse to manufacture more dartboards. But now, Carl owns millions of shares of unproven stock.
Yeah, he's holding the bag.
Exactly. If Carl can't find anyone to buy these shares from him, he eats the loss.
Mm.
The risk is entirely on the underwriter. Carl is acting as a principal or a dealer buying for his own firm's inventory. Hence the name, he's firmly committed to buying it all.
But what if Carl looks at the inflatable dartboard market and thinks, this is incredibly risky. I am not tying up my firm's capital in this.
Right. He's cautious.
Exactly. Cautious Carl.
Yeah.
He would refuse a firm commitment and instead offer Frank a best efforts agreement. In a best efforts deal, Carl acts purely as an agent. He promises to use his firm's network to try his best to sell the shares to the public. But whatever who doesn't sell, those unsold shares just go right back to Frank.
Ah.
So in this scenario, the financial risk remains squarely on the issuer, on Frank.
And there are also a couple of interesting subsets of best efforts, right?
Yeah.
Like all or none, where the entire offering is canceled and all investor money is refunded if they can't sell every single share.
Right.
Or mini-max, where they have to hit a specific minimum threshold of sales to close the deal, and then they can keep selling up to a maximum. But the core thread connecting all of them is that the underwriter is just an agent, not the outright buyer.
Exactly. Now, investment banks are not charities. They take on this massive undertaking because they get paid handsomely. And the way they get paid is called the underwriting spread.
Right.
The spread is the price difference between what the general public pays for the stock and what Frank, the issuer, actually receives in his bank account.
Think of the gross spread as a large pizza that gets sliced into three distinct pieces. The first slice is the management fee. This is usually about 10 to 20% of the spread, and it goes straight to Cautious Carl, the lead underwriter, as a fee for negotiating the deal and managing the syndicate.
Right. And the second slice is the underwriting fee. This is roughly another 20%. This goes to the actual syndicate members based on their specific allocation of the stock, and it compensates them for taking on the financial risk of a firm commitment. It's their reward for putting their capital on the line.
Which leaves the final, largest slice of the pizza roughly 60% of the total spread. This is the selling concession.
60%.
Huge slice. And this slice goes to whoever actually finds a retail buyer and gets them to purchase the shares. Now, I have another direct question for the listener. Let's look at selling group Sam. Remember, Sam is just in the selling group. He's not a full syndicate member. If Sam sells 1,000 shares of Frank's stock to his retail clients, does Sam assume any underwriting risk? Hold that thought.
The answer is no, not a single dime. Sam does not risk any of his firm's capital. If he doesn't sell shares, he just doesn't get paid. But if he does sell shares, he earns the selling concession.
I really want to flag this because test writers love this specific dynamic. They want you to assume that the lead underwriter, Cautious Carl, takes the biggest percentage cut because he manages the whole operation.
Yeah, it feels intuitive.
Right. But the reality is that the selling concession is the largest component of the spread. Finding end buyers and actually distributing the stock is the hardest part of the business. So the people doing that grunt work get the biggest percentage of the spread.
And as a quick formula to remember, if a firm acts as both the underwriter taking the risk and the seller placing the shares with a client, they earn both the underwriting fee and the selling concession.
Okay.
When you add those two together, it is called the total takedown. It's the maximum amount a syndicate member can earn per share.
Total takedown. Good to know. So we have all this money flying around. Cautious Carl and Selling Group Sam stand to make a massive commission if this IPO goes well. But when there is that much money on the table, the temptation to engage in under-the-table deals is just huge.
Naturally.
So how does the SEC stop underwriters from just hoarding all the best, most profitable shares for their wealthy buddies and completely ignoring the retail public.
Yeah, this is a critical area of regulation. Fenera has strict rules to ensure what they call a bona fide public distribution. They want to guarantee that the general public actually has a fair shot at buying into hot IPOs.
Okay.
To enforce this, they created a strict list of restricted persons who are legally barred from buying a new equity IPO at the public offering twice.
And if you are deeply embedded in the financial industry, you are likely on this list. Broker dealers and their employees cannot buy the IPO. Portfolio managers who make buying decisions at banks or mutual funds cannot buy it.
Right.
Anyone who owns more than 10% of a broker dealer is restricted. And crucially, the immediate family members of all these people are also restricted. Mm-hmm. Your spouse, your kids, your parents, your in-laws, they cannot scoop up the hot IPO shares.
But there is a practical loophole to this called the de minimis exemption.
Oh, tell me about that.
Let's say a restricted person, like a broker dealer employee, has their retirement money invested in a massive mutual fund. And that mutual fund wants to buy shares in Frank's IPO. Technically, a restricted person is benefiting from that purchase.
Right, indirectly.
Exactly. But the rule states the fund can still buy the shares as long as the restricted person's beneficial interest does not exceed 10% of the total account. A tiny bit of indirect exposure is fine. They just can't dominate the fund to bypass the rule.
Okay, that makes sense. Which brings us to another character we need to introduce, Sneaky Steve. Sneaky Steve is a high-level corporate executive at a completely different massive Fortune 500 company. Cautious Carl, our underwriter, desperately wants Steve's massive company to hire his investment bank for future corporate loans.
Of course he does.
Right. So Carl calls up Sneaky Steve and says, "Hey, Steve, Frank's inflatable dartboard IPO is heavily oversubscribed. It is going to double in price on day one. I'm going to secretly allocate 10,000 shares of this hot IPO directly into your personal account. In exchange, I'd love it if you hired my firm next time your company needs a $1 billion debt offering."
Yeah, what Carl is doing is highly illegal.
Highly.
It is a specific violation of the new issue allocation rules known as spinning.
Spinning.
You are using hot IPO shares to induce or bribe a corporate insider into giving you future investment banking business.
Like spinning a web to catch a lucrative client.
Exactly.
And when you take the Series 7, they might describe this exact scenario with Sneaky Steve, but they might not explicitly use the word spinning in the question stem. You have to recognize the underlying mechanism, right?
Yeah.
Trading hot IPO shares for future corporate business equals a severe violation.
Definitely. And while we're talking about maintaining a fair market, we have to talk about price manipulation during an IPO, which falls under Regulation M.
Okay, Reg M.
Regulation M is a sprawling SEC rule designed to prevent market manipulation during a distribution. The core logic is simple. During the offering, the underwriters and the issuer cannot bid up the price of the stock in the open market. They cannot artificially manufacture demand to make the stock look more popular than it actually is.
But there is one massive, fascinating exception to this rule. It's called stabilization. I want to challenge this concept for a second because it sounds crazy to me.
Lay on me.
Stabilization is basically Cautious Carl putting a giant foam mattress underneath Frank's stock price on the first day of trading, stepping in as a buyer to make sure the price doesn't crash completely. How is that not market manipulation?
It absolutely is market manipulation.
Oh.
In fact, it is literally the only form of legal price manipulation authorized in the U.S. securities markets.
Wait, the SEC explicitly authorizes underwriters to manipulate the price of a stock?
They do. And the why is deeply rooted in market psychology.
Yeah.
A failed IPO where a stock opens and immediately craters by 40% causes widespread panic. It destroys capital, it ruins the company's reputation, and it spooks the entire financial system. So the SEC allows the lead underwriter to step in and act as a buyer of last resort to stabilize the price.
Wow.
But they put a straitjacket of rules around it, and the intent to stabilize must be clearly disclosed in the prospectus.
Okay, I want everyone to burn this next rule into your brain because it's tested constantly. Where is Carl legally allowed to place this stabilizing bid?
A stabilizing bid can only be placed at or below the public offering price. It can never, ever be placed above it.
Let's apply numbers to make that concrete. Frank's stock officially goes public at $20 a share. On the morning of the IPO, it starts trading and immediately tanks to $18 because everyone realizes inflatable dartboards are stupid. Carl can place a stabilizing bid at $18 to stop the bleeding, right?
Yes. He can follow the market down and support it at 18.
But what if the stock shoots up to 25 and then starts to dip back to 24? Can Carl place a stabilizing bid at 24 to keep the momentum going?
Absolutely never.
Okay.
The hard ceiling is always the initial public offering price, which was $20. The moment you place a bid above that offering price, you are no longer stabilizing. You are artificially inflating. You cross the line from legal support to illegal manipulation, and you invite the SEC to basically end your career.
That makes total sense. Now, what happens if Selling Group Sam sells the IPO to his retail clients at 20, and the moment the market opens, those clients immediately sell the stock at 22 to lock in a quick $2 profit?
Ah, that practice is called flipping. Underwriters despise flipping because it creates massive downward selling pressure on the stock, which forces conscious Carl to spend millions of his firm's own dollars buying those flipped shares to stabilize the price.
Right.
To combat this, Carl can impose what's called a penalty bid.
How does a penalty bid work?
If Sam's client flips the stock in the immediate aftermarket, Carl tracks that trade back to Sam, and Carl can legally revoke and take back the entire selling concession that he originally paid to Sam.
That is brutal.
Very.
Sam does all the work to find the client gets greedy and flips it, and Sam loses his entire paycheck.
Yeah.
But I guess the mechanism forces Sam to aggressively vet his clients and only sell IPO shares to long-term buy-and-hold investors rather than day traders looking for a quick buck.
Precisely. It aligns the incentives of the selling group with the stability of the IPO.
Okay, if you are zoning out, come back to me because we are about to completely change the game. Shake it out, refocus.
Here we go.
We are leaving the world of massive, highly regulated public IPOs. Frank, the founder, looks at the millions of dollars in legal fees, the 20-day cooling off period, and the massive SEC oversight, and he says, I don't have the time or the money for this. How does he raise money without throwing the massive SEC party?
He uses the side doors.
The side doors.
He uses exempt offerings. These are regulations that allow a company to skip the full SEC registration process if they meet very specific criteria. And the two giants in this space are Regulation A and Regulation D. You need to be able to compare them.
Let's start with Regulation A. I think of Reg A as a mini IPO for small businesses. You still have to interact with the SEC, but the barrier to entry is much lower. You use a shorter, simpler document called Form 1A, and instead of handing out a massive phone book-sized prospectus, you provide investors with an offering circular.
And Reg A is split into two tiers based on how much money you want to raise. Tier 1 allows a company to raise up to $20 million in a 12-month period. Tier 2 allows you to raise up to $75 million.
Beyond the dollar amounts, what is the mechanical difference between the two tiers?
It comes down to audits and state regulators.
Okay.
Tier 2, the larger tier, requires the company to provide audited financial statements. But in exchange, it preempts state blue sky laws, meaning Frank doesn't have to individually register his stock with regulators in all 50 states.
No thanks.
Tier 1 is the inverse. It does not require audited financials, which saves Frank money, but he does have to deal with registering in every individual state where he sells shares, which is a massive headache.
Yeah, 50 registrations sounds awful. And here's the defining characteristic of Reg A. The SEC still has to formally qualify the offering before you can make sales. But once the investors buy those shares, they are freely tradable in the public market.
Freely tradable.
That is a stark contrast to our next exemption, Regulation D.
Yeah, Regulation D is the private placement exemption. This is not a mini IPO. With Reg D, Frank is bypassing the public entirely and selling his stock directly to wealthy individuals and massive institutions.
Right.
The beauty of Reg D is that Frank does not have to wait for the SEC to qualify or prove anything. He just goes out, sells the shares, and then files a simple Form D with the SEC after the first sale is made.
But the massive trade-off for that speed and lack of oversight is that the shares Frank sells are restricted.
Highly restricted.
The buyers cannot immediately turn around and trade them on the open market. They are locked in.
Exactly. Now, the rules for who Frank can actually sell these Reg D shares to depend entirely on one major distinction: general solicitation versus no solicitation.
And this is all about advertising, right?
Right.
So if Frank decides not to advertise, meaning he just quietly calls up rich venture capitalists he already knows, which is no solicitation, the SEC gives him some leeway. He can sell to an unlimited number of accredited investors, and he is allowed to include up to 35 non-accredited investors.
And accredited investors are essentially defined by wealth. They need an annual income of over $200,000 or $300,000 with a spouse. Or they need a net worth of over $1 million, specifically excluding the value of their primary residence.
And because Frank isn't blasting this opportunity to the vulnerable public, the SEC lets him use the honor system. An investor can just check a box on a form saying, yes, I am accredited, and Frank can reasonably rely on that signature.
Right.
But what if Frank gets greedy? Ask yourself this. What if Frank puts up a massive billboard on the highway and runs Facebook ads advertising his RegD private placement? That is general solicitation. If he does that, can he still just have investors check a box saying they make over 200K?
The answer is absolutely not.
Not at all.
The moment you use general solicitation, the entire regulatory landscape shifts. This is a massive exam trap.
Walk us through what changes.
First, if you advertise, you lose the 35 non-accredited investors. Your buyer pool must be 100% accredited. You cannot sell to regular folks.
Zero regular folks.
Right. Second, and more importantly, you can no longer trust a checkbox. The burden of proof shifts to the issuer. Frank must take reasonable steps to verify that the investors are actually wealthy.
Which means Frank has to demand to see their W-2s, their personal tax returns, the bank statements, or he has to get a legally binding letter from their CPA or attorney verifying their net worth.
Correct. The SEC basically says, if you want to advertise private stock to the masses, you have to prove to us that the people buying it can actually afford to lose all their money.
So, to summarize the RegD trap, no advertising means you can have 35 regular folks. Checkboxes are fine. Yes, advertising means only rich people, and you better audit their tax returns.
That is the exact takeaway.
Beautiful. There's one more side door we need to cover, the intrastate offering. This is often referred to as the 80% rule.
Yeah, the intrastate exemption is based on the idea that if a company's entire economic existence is contained within the borders of a single state, it shouldn't fall under federal SEC jurisdiction.
Makes sense.
If a company is organized in a state, doing business in that state, and only selling stock to residents of that state, they are exempt from federal registration.
But the phrase doing business is kind of vague. The SEC quantified it with the 80% rule. To qualify, the company must derive at least 80% of its gross revenues from that state, or have 80% of its assets located in that state, or use 80% of the offering proceeds within that state.
But the trap here is the residency requirement for the buyers.
Let's do a scenario. Let's say Frank does an intrastate offering in Texas. He carefully vets 500 investors, verifying they all have Texas addresses. But it turns out one single guy just moved and secretly lives across the border in Oklahoma. What happens to Frank's exemption?
The entire exemption blows up. It is voided.
Boom.
The intrastate rule requires 100% of the buyers to be residents of the state. It is not an 80% rule for the buyers. One single sale to an out-of-state buyer destroys the exemption for the whole offering, and Frank is suddenly guilty of an unregistered illegal federal securities offering.
Oh, man. And if you are a Texas resident who successfully buys those intrastate shares, you are locked in. The rules prohibit you from reselling those shares to anyone out of state for a full 6 months. You can trade them with other Texans, but they cannot cross state lines.
Which leads us perfectly into the next major hurdle. Let's say you are one of the wealthy venture capitalists who bought restricted stock in Frank's RegD private placement.
Okay.
As we established, those shares are restricted. You are stuck holding them. The obvious question is, how do you eventually get out? How do you sell them and cash in?
You use Rule 144. Rule 144 is the regulatory safe harbor that dictates exactly how you can legally resell restricted or control stock into the public secondary market. But let's look at the why first. Why do these holding periods even exist? Why can't I just buy Frank's private stock on a Monday and then immediately sell it on the New York Stock Exchange on a Tuesday?
Because if the SEC allowed you to do that, the private placement exemption would just be a giant loophole. It would be a disguised public offering.
Right.
Frank could sell all his unregistered stock to you at a wholesale discount, and you would effectively act as an unregistered underwriter, dumping those unvetted shares onto the retail public the very next day.
And the SEC hates that.
They do. The SEC prevents this by enforcing holding periods. They are essentially saying, if you want the privilege of buying private stock, you have to take real investment risk. You have to hold it, let your capital sit there, and ride the market waves before you can flip it.
Okay, so let's break down the mechanics of Rule 144. It is best understood by doing a side-by-side comparison of the two types of people who use it, affiliates versus non-affiliates.
Right. An affiliate is an insider. It's a corporate officer, a member of the board of directors, or anyone who owns more than 10% of the company's voting stock. They have control.
And a non-affiliate.
A non-affiliate is just a regular outside investor who happens to own restricted stock.
Let's look at the holding period first.
The holding period is actually identical for both groups. If the company is a reporting company, meaning they already file regular financial reports like 10-Ks with the SEC, the mandatory hold is 6 months. If they're a non-reporting private company, the holding period stretches to 1 year.
So you wait out your 6 months, then what?
If you are a non-affiliate, you are basically free. After that six-month hold, as long as there is current public information available about the company, you can sell as much stock as you want. There are no volume limits. You can liquidate your entire position.
Okay, but if you are an affiliate, if you are Frank the founder himself trying to sell his own personal shares.
Frank is never truly free.
Poor Frank.
Because he is an insider, even after the six-month hold, affiliates face incredibly strict volume limits. The rule states that in any 90-day period, Frank can only sell the greater of 1% of the total outstanding shares of the company or the average weekly trading volume of the stock over the previous 4 weeks.
Okay, let's do the math on that. So if Frank's company has 10 million shares outstanding, 1% is 100,000 shares. If the 4-week trading average is only 80,000 shares, Frank can sell 100,000 shares over the next 3 months. Why is the SEC micromanaging his personal trades like this?
To prevent market collapse. If an insider suddenly dumps massive amounts of stock, it signals to the market that the company is doomed, the price crashes, and retail investors get crushed.
Right.
It also prevents insiders from bypassing the registration process by slowly flooding the market with unregistered shares.
Okay, and this brings up a piece of paperwork that trips up a lot of test takers. Form 144, the rule says affiliates must file Form 144 with the SEC if they are selling over 5,000 shares or $50,000 worth of stock in a 90-day window. Now, I want to clarify how this works in practice. Is Form 144 a hard ceiling?
Like a cap.
Yeah. For example, if I hit 5,000 shares, does the form mean I just legally cannot sell anymore?
That is the most common misunderstanding of this rule. Form 144 is not a ceiling. It is just a notice of your intent to sell.
Oh.
The actual ceiling, the absolute limit on how much you can sell, is that volume formula we just did the math on, the greater of 1% or the weekly average.
Okay.
You might be legally allowed to sell 1 million shares based on that formula. But the moment your intended sale crosses that tiny threshold of 5,000 shares or $50,000, you are required to file the form to notify the SEC that you are about to dump stock. The formula is the limit. The form is just the notification.
That distinction makes so much sense. Formula is limit. Form is notice. Now, what if I am a massive hedge fund? I just bought RegD restricted stock and I absolutely refuse to wait 6 months. I want to sell it tomorrow. Is there any way around the holding period?
There is one VIP shortcut. It is called Rule 144A.
144A.
And it is exclusively for QIBs.
QIB, qualified institutional buyer.
Exactly. A QIB is an institution like an insurance company or an investment company that owns and invests at least $100 million in discretionary securities. If it's a broker dealer, the threshold is $10 million.
Big money.
Under Rule 144A, these massive, sophisticated institutions can trade unregistered, restricted stock amongst themselves with absolutely no holding period.
Zero hold.
Zero.
It is a private, multi-million dollar sandbox where the normal rules don't apply because the SEC assumes these players are rich and smart enough to protect themselves. But retail investors are entirely locked out of this sandbox. You cannot sell 144A stock to an individual, no matter how many billions of dollars they have. It is institution to institution only.
Correct. Only QIB to QIB.
All right, let's leave the U.S. entirely. Let's say Frank gives up on the SEC, the QIBs, the holding periods, all of it. He wants to sell his inflatable dartboard stock offshore to foreign investors.
To do that legally, he would use Regulation S, Reg S governs offers and sales made outside the United States. If Frank follows the rules, no SEC registration is required.
The mechanism that makes Reg S work is that it is defined by residence, not citizenship. Let me ask you listening question. If Frank sells his unregistered offshore stock to a U.S. citizen who has lived and worked in Paris for the last 10 years, does that violate Reg S? Give it a thought.
The answer is no.
No.
It is perfectly legal. The person resides abroad. The SEC is concerned with where the transaction is happening and where the economic reality of the person is located, not what passport they carry. A U.S. citizen living in Paris is treated as an offshore investor.
But there is a trap here. What is the one thing Frank cannot do while running a Reg S offering?
He cannot engage in any directed selling efforts within the U.S. He can't run ads in the Wall Street Journal promoting his offshore offering to drum up backdoor U.S. interest and, more importantly, to prevent the offshore stock from immediately flowing right back into the U.S. market, the SEC imposes a distribution compliance period.
It's essentially a lockup.
Exactly. For debt securities, it's usually 40 days. For certain equities, it can be a full year. During that lockup period, the Reg S stock cannot be sold back to U.S. persons.
While we are exploring the international side of things, we have to mention OFAC and the SDN list.
Oh, yeah. OFAC is the Office of Foreign Assets Control, a division of the U.S. Treasury. They publish a master document called the Specially Designated Nationals List, the SDN list. This is essentially a roster of terrorists, international drug cartels, and individuals sanctioned by the U.S. government.
So, if a broker-dealer is processing a routine trade and the buyer's name pops up as a match on the SDN list, what is the exact mechanism they must follow?
Well, the very first step is to escalate it internally to the compliance department to make sure it's not a false positive. You don't want to freeze someone's account because they share a name with a cartel leader.
That would be awkward.
Right. But if compliance confirms it's a real hit, the broker must execute a three-step protocol: block, reject, and report. They must block the assets, meaning freeze the account so the money can't move. They must reject the transaction, and they must report the incident to OFAC within 10 days.
Block, reject, report.
Block, reject, report.
That is a very clean sequence to remember for the exam.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's pivot to a completely different animal. Municipal securities. Let's say Frank's hometown decides they want to build a massive multi-million dollar stadium specifically to host inflatable dartboard tournaments.
A great use of taxpayer money.
Obviously. So the city needs to raise money, so they issue municipal bonds.
The most fundamental thing you need to know about municipal bonds, which is city, state, or local government debt, is that they do not use SEC registration.
Right.
They are explicitly exempt under the Securities Act of 1933. And because they don't register with the SEC, they do not use a traditional prospectus.
Instead, the municipal bond market is governed by its own self-regulatory organization, the MSRB, the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board. When a city wants to sell bonds to an underwriter, they generally use one of two methods: competitive or negotiated sales.
In a competitive sale, the city publishes a formal notice of sale. It's an open invitation to the financial world. Various underwriting syndicates analyze the deal, do the math, and submit sealed bids.
Like an auction.
Yeah. And the city opens the bids, and the syndicate that offers to borrow the money at the lowest interest rate wins the deal. It's highly objective.
In a negotiated sale.
A negotiated sale is much more relationship-based. The city just pre-selects an underwriter they trust, they sit down at a table, and they negotiate the interest rates and terms directly.
Okay, let's say Cautious Carl wins a competitive bid for the dartboard stadium bonds. He forms a municipal syndicate. Now, municipal bonds are often incredibly popular because the interest is tax-free, meaning there is usually more demand from investors than there are bonds available. Because of this, the MSRB has strict rules on how Carl allocates the bonds.
Yes. MSRB rules require the syndicate to establish a written priority provision. It dictates the exact order in which incoming orders get filled.
There is a fantastic mnemonic to remember the standard MSRB priority order. It is PGDM. Please get dessert made. PGDM.
You break those down.
Okay. P is for presale orders. G is for group net orders. D is for designated orders. And M is for member orders. Please get dessert made. Pre-sale, group, designated, member.
You definitely need to memorize that order, but you also need to understand the underlying law driving it. Historically, if a municipal bond was really attractive, syndicate members would just hoard all the best bonds for their own firm's proprietary trading accounts, leaving retail customers with nothing.
Which defeats the purpose of a public offering entirely.
Exactly. So the MSRB stepped in. The golden rule behind PGDM is that the first three categories, pre-sale, group, and designated, are all orders placed for outside customers. The very last category, member orders, are orders placed for the syndicate member's own internal account. The MSRB forces you by law to fill all customer orders before you fill a single member order.
The customer always eats before the syndicate does.
Exactly.
And earlier we mentioned that municipal bonds don't use a prospectus. What disclosure document do they use instead?
They use an official statement, or OS.
Official statement.
Functionally, it serves the exact same purpose as a prospectus. It airs the primary disclosure document detailing the town's financials and the risks of the stadium. But because munis are exempt from the SEC, it has a different legal title.
Official statement. Got it. Okay, we are entering the final stretch. Let's cover three miscellaneous housekeeping rules that FINRA absolutely loves to weave into the exam.
Rule one, bank networking. It is very common for a broker-dealer to rent a desk and operate inside a retail bank lobby.
Right. But think about the psychology of a customer there.
Hmm.
An elderly client walks into their local bank, sits down at a desk, and buys a mutual fund from the broker. Subconsciously, they assume that investment is as safe as their savings account because they are physically sitting in a bank.
Which is incredibly dangerous. To combat this confusion, the rule requires the broker to clearly, explicitly disclose three facts before any sale.
Three facts.
They must state that the securities are not FDIC insured, they are not bank deposits, and they are not guaranteed by the bank. They involve investment risk and can lose value. You have to aggressively separate the broker from the bank in the client's mind.
Rule 2. The taping rule. FINRA actively tracks broker-dealers that get shut down or expelled for fraud or abusive sales practices. If a legitimate firm starts hiring too many registered reps from those disciplined firms, meaning they're hiring a bunch of bad apples with a history of sketchy behavior, FINRA intervenes.
And if a firm crosses a specific threshold of hiring reps from disciplined firms, they trigger the taping rule. The firm is legally required to install systems to tape record all telephone conversations between its reps and both existing and potential customers.
Wow.
Yeah, it is an intense, expensive compliance mandate designed to monitor firms that have built a high-risk workforce.
Finally, Rule 3. The Trust Indenture Act of 1939. This rule has a massive exam trap built right into it.
It does. The Trust Indenture Act requires that if a corporation issues a massive amount of debt to the public, they have to appoint a trustee, usually a commercial bank, to act as a fiduciary for the bondholders. The Trust Indenture is a legal contract that spells out exactly what rights the bondholders have if the corporation goes bankrupt or defaults.
But the trap is in who this act applies to. The Trust Indenture Act applies only to corporate debt offered to the public in excess of $10 million. It does not apply to equity stock. It does not apply to municipal bonds. It is strictly for corporate debt over $10 million. If you see a question asking about a municipal bond trustee, the Trust Indenture Act is the wrong answer.
That is a crucial distinction. Always check the asset class.
Okay, take a breath. We made it through the dense material.
We did it.
To lock this in, we are going to do a rapid-fire recap. I am going to hit the top five testable takeaways from this entire deep dive to ensure they are burned into your short-term memory.
Let's run it.
Number one, the red herring, also known as the preliminary prospectus. It is used during the 20-day cooling-off period to gather indications of interest, but it deliberately omits the final price, and it cannot be used to collect actual money or make sales.
Perfect. Number two, the underwriting spread. The selling concession is the absolute largest piece of the spread. And remember, selling group members take zero financial risk. They do not buy the stock. They only get paid a commission if they successfully sell it.
Number three, Regulation M stabilization. Stabilizing bids are the only legal form of price manipulation, but they can never, ever go above the public offering price. The offering price is the hard ceiling.
Right. Number four, Regulation D, general solicitation. If a company advertises a private placement, they lose the ability to use a simple checkbox to prove wealth. They must actively verify every investor's accredited status by checking tax forms, W-2s, or a CPA letter.
And number five, Rule 144. Form 144 is merely a notice you file when an intended sale crosses 5,000 shares or $50,000. It's not a volume cap. The actual mathematical cap for affiliates is the greater of 1% of outstanding shares or the four-week average trading volume.
If you know those five concepts, Cole, you are in great shape.
Definitely. So to close out this deep dive, I want to leave you with a provocative thought to ponder while you grind through your practice exams. Think back to stabilization under Regulation M. The SEC strictly, viciously prohibits manipulating stock prices. I mean, people go to federal prison for doing it. Unless you are the lead underwriter preventing an IPO from failing on day one. What does it say about the underlying psychology of the financial market? That the system explicitly authorizes illegal manipulation just to stop retail investors from panicking? Is the free market really free? Or is it so inherently fragile that it needs a giant foam mattress to survive its own anxiety?
It is a fascinating contradiction. The very foundation of market integrity sometimes requires a controlled legal suspension of the rules just to keep the lights on.
It's wild. Something to mull over. Keep studying. Trust the mechanics of the system, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.